Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Reason luminaries Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Matt Welch. Although Matt Welch isn't actually here today, he's away for a very legal, very understandable reason, boring even. If you said, is Matt up to anything nefarious or illegal, I would say, Matt is an upstanding American who is in no way absent due to extra legal shenanigans, and I would plead the fifth if subpoenaed. In his place is Reason's Eric Bame. Welcome, Eric.
How you doing? Glad to be here.
So today we're going to discuss the role of football as an institution within our republic, Graham Cassidy, and the Republican fever dreams of tax reform. But we'll start off with football. President Trump on Sunday called for football fans to boycott the NFL because players had made the game political, according to him, by sitting rather than standing during the national anthem, and he said that they should stop disrespecting our flag and country. He also weighed in on the game itself in a kind of bar conversation, saying that referees who penalize players for hitting too hard are ruining the game, and all of this followed a Friday rally in Alabama, where he skewered a number of people, but focused on football and presumably focused on Colin Kaepernick, who kind of kicked off the whole sitting rather than standing during a game. So we now have one more element of American culture that is political. I think we're down to two things that aren't political, and one of them's the weather, maybe. Eric, why is this a
wrong
thing?
Did you read any of the hurricane coverage?
Where have you been lately? Never mind. There's literally
bluegrass at this point. Might be non-political.
I was going to say the Fuller House reboot on Netflix. Although, you know, then they had that whole abortion sequence in the second and third
episode.
That was a
weird thing. I agree. Okay, there's nothing left. It's all super political now. And football is the primitive one in that. So, Eric, why is this a thing? Why is this happening? Why is this such a big focus for President Trump?
Yeah, I wish I could give you a solid answer on this. I think anybody who wants, anybody who thinks Trump was going to run government like a business or like one of his businesses has been sorely disappointed. We didn't elect a businessman. We didn't even elect a reality TV star. I think we elected a radio shock jock. This is like the type of stuff you would hear on Philly talk radio, you know, talking about the Eagles and the Phillies and whatnot. I mean, that's the sort of thing you're getting out of this president so far on Twitter. So, yeah, just to go back, all of this started last year. Colin Kaepernick, who was at the time a quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, a pretty successful one, had taken the 49ers to a Super Bowl, was about 5 yards away from winning that Super Bowl, had gotten them back to one game short of the Super Bowl a year after that, and then 2 years later was benched. But last year, while he was riding the pine, he decided he was going to make a protest against police violence towards African Americans. I think a worthy cause, something that he is using his platform as a popular celebrity athlete to advance, and he was going to take a knee during the national anthem, and he started doing this. A few other players went along with it as well. Mostly it was just Kaepernick. This year, some more players have joined, and significantly they've started doing it. One of the most notable is Michael Bennett of the Seattle Seahawks, who, of course, had his own run-in with the police a few weeks ago in Las Vegas. We covered that at Reason.com. And this year, other players have sort of taken up the mantle for Kaepernick because he is not on the field to kneel during the national anthem because he has not been signed by a team. And there's some controversy and suspicion that perhaps the NFL owners have conspired against him. Again, he's a rather talented quarterback, certainly better than some of the scrubs that you see out there on Sundays. So this has become a national discussion to some, you know, minor extent at least, or a part of the ongoing national discussion about police violence, particularly towards African Americans. And Donald Trump, as he is wont to do, turned this controversy into a controversy about Donald Trump, and which is now centered on Donald Trump rather than what it was before. Well, and so we could talk about
He also, Donald Trump, though, unwittingly has managed to unite the NFL, the owners and the players, which is amazing because owners and players in the NFL are generally at each other's throats. But USA Today has a headline saying, you know, along the lines of NFL, and I'm looking at it now semi in the dark, but it's NFL finds unity in its rebuke of Trump. Because when Trump said this and the between the speech that Eric mentioned in Alabama and then a bunch of tweets where he said anybody in any league, male or female, any professional athlete who's making a lot of money who disrespects the flag and the national anthem should be, you know, he's like, you're fired from The Apprentice. And to its credit, before this, the NFL, which has a number of problems with it, and I'm no fan of the NFL, but they have slumping ratings, which have little to do with this, although this is probably not helping. They have maxed out interest. There's a lot of pushback, or people are losing interest in the NFL as they realize that it's a, you know, basically the players who participate in it, they get paid a lot, and then they sacrifice their sanity and their old age and their retirement to various kinds of injury, including traumatic brain injuries. Trump has managed to unite the NFL owners and players, and the NFL already had a policy in place that said, we're going to let people do whatever they want as long as it's not totally disruptive. It's fascinating to think about this story in a couple ways. And one is the culture war aspect, because now everybody in the country who gives a shit about any of this has to either be like, are you on the take a knee side? Or are you like, no, this is just a game and politics has no place in it. It's fascinating in that context to know that it wasn't even until 2009 that the NFL insisted that all players be on the sidelines for the national anthem. Before that, it was left up to teams to decide. So this is kind of a fake concept that, the NFL is somehow not being patriotic enough. There was also in 2009, it came to light, Jeff Flake and John McCain issued a report about how the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, had been paying NFL teams to advertise or put in patriotic displays at football games, at halftime shows, pregame shows. It's not clear if that standing at the sidelines since 2009 was part of this pay-to-play deal as well, or an advertising deal. There's that, and that. While that is interesting, I think the more serious question here is, you know, what the fuck is the president doing talking about this kind of stuff? It's not as if there aren't other things to do, and it's not as if he doesn't have a full plate on his hand. And I'm a big fan of Jack Schaefer of Politico, who always talks about, you know, when Trump starts tweeting, the point isn't to engage the tweets. It's to look around and see what is he diverting attention from. I'm not exactly sure what that is right now. It might be the overall kind of torpor in many ways of his presidency. He has not been able to repeal and replace Obamacare as he promised. He has not been able to do a lot of the things that he's promised. And I don't know if this is just one more way of diverting people's attention from a kind of slow-moving train wreck that is the major legislation that he promised to pass, which he has yet to do.
I actually want to bring in Stephen Mnuchin's comments here, because I think, you know, that's the other piece of this that is pretty serious, frankly. He said, the Treasury Secretary said, they can do free speech in their own time, that they have a right to free speech off the field. And not to get all Wally Olson on y'all, but like, who? This is actually an interesting Wally Olson, has written a huge amount about the ways in which we are gradually tolerating the erosion of our speech rights in a professional context. And this came up around the Google memo, around the James Damore memo about, you know, what can you say at work? But I think that idea is really permeating our society, that somehow you don't have full speech rights when you're in a place of work, that when you offend someone or when you somehow run against the mores of your profession, the First Amendment doesn't apply. And that is incredibly poisonous. I mean, of course, ultimately, as a crazy pants libertarian, I believe that the NFL should feel free to fire every single person who refuses to come out for the national anthem if they so choose. Don't love the bully pulpit element of it, but mostly think that these comments from the Secretary of the Treasury, not just some random guy, that we don't have First Amendment rights in the course of performing our paid jobs is deeply alarming.
And just to,
so
just
you're
kinda...
you're going to be bringing back the free Mumia shirt T-shirt.
Yeah, I'm also going
to
take a knee when Reason does the.
So I agree with.
Well, we only do the international, right? So, or the Canadian national anthem, we play that every day at work.
I think we should have played the national anthem at the opening of the podcast. I mean, I feel very unpatriotic that we're sitting around having a conversation without having
a good point. It's like we didn't sanctify the podcast.
I don't know why we didn't.
So
do that.
I want to push back against you guys. Yes, it was my fault. I should have enforced that.
By the way, this is hardly the first time though that the president of the United States has weighed in on football in general. Teddy Roosevelt in the early part of the 20th century, college football had a period where there were a number of deaths, from people playing.
Knife fights.
That's when football
Roosevelt
was good.
Yeah, that's right. When it was a real sport, you know.
Just to
without
be clear,
all of this,
I don't think that was good. I think it was barbaric and awful, and I'm glad that we're moving away from
but
it.
But he essentially called in kind of presidents and coaches or the powers that be at major football universities, which were mostly on the East Coast at that point and part of the Ivy League. But and he said, "You guys got to clean up this act, otherwise we're going to have to ban football." And they did. John Miller, who teaches at Hillsdale College and writes at the National Review, has written a pretty interesting book about that. I find it appalling, you know, that the president would be, you know, getting involved in that. Barack Obama also weighed in on the bowl championship.
They love doing that, though, right? Because whenever politicians can talk, like there were the baseball hearings that happened in the late 90s, and every single congressman was able to come out and toss out some anecdotes about how much they liked their local baseball team, and it makes them all look like they're regular Joes. So politicians always love weighing in on athletics if they can.
Yeah. But I think Catherine is right on the larger issue here is that kind of workplace speech rights, because, and I know I've written something about this at Reason, and I was kind of engaging on Twitter about it, and people were like, you know, I first when I saw Trump's tweet, I was like, you know, this isn't his business, literally and figuratively. And then a bunch of people are saying like, oh, are you saying he can't have an opinion? And this strikes me as one of the issues with like a lot of Trump supporters is that they will simultaneously claim that the president is just another person so he can say whatever he wants. And, you know, what are you saying? Like, you can't have an opinion on something. But then if you engage the opinion and disagree, then they get all pissed about that. And you can't have it both ways. And I think I'm very confident that Trump is the effect of other things that have happened in American society, including this kind of weirdness about speech. Because, I mean, he really did. And I know, Catherine, you've talked about this. You know, he came in as the destroyer of political correctness. He was finally going to allow people to talk about things that we couldn't talk about because of social mores and, you know, political correctness and all of that. But he and his followers also get really pissy when you actually engage their opinions and say, no, you're wrong about that. So it's a very bizarre kind of public conversation that we're tending to have. And it does, to the extent I think that it directs away from Trump's first, you know, priorities and responsibilities as president, it's dangerous. But then on a much more profound level, and Catherine, I thank you for, you know, putting it in that context of this broader workplace, you know, the idea now that the workplace is simultaneously hyper-politicized, you know, so that the government can tell anybody that they have to provide whatever service to anybody, no matter what, or that everything is subject to public and private regulation, but you also can't talk
about
stuff.
See, that's where I want to push back a little bit on you guys. I agree with you on the basic premise that the NFL can fire or hire anybody for whatever reason they want because it's a private entity. But in terms of the cultural effects of what's going on, I don't like that everything in culture is getting politicized. I think it would be healthy for there to be just kind of zones of American society that aren't terribly political. So while I'm not offended by a football player refusing to stand during the pledge, I don't really care either way. I am irritated by the fact that they're thrusting that into a public debate and taking it out of a somewhat neutral context.
It's a great place to do it.
Aren't you kind of engaging, though, in a little bit of golden ageism here? I mean, I'm not convinced that there was ever anything that was free of politics, although the form is a little bit different now. I mean, you know, Hollywood blacklists existed and...
The NFL was segregated until the 40s, baseball until the 40s.
Baseball,
so you can say,
segregated.
Oh, you know, I look back. Yeah, it's like, oh, what a, you know, went back before, you know, all of baseball or football or basketball became about politics. And it's like, yeah, because politics had ruled out blacks playing.
You had the African Americans
who
won medals
form.
At the Mexico City Olympics, who stood on the medal platform with their fists raised. I mean, sports has always sort of had an intersection with politics, particularly racial politics. I think the difference is that when those previous events happen, and Nick, you pointed out Teddy Roosevelt got involved in college football a long time ago. Sure, there were the baseball hearings, but I mean, when we had these other sort of instances where sports and politics mixed together and the line blurred there a bit, you didn't have presidents coming out and talking about it. You didn't have when Muhammad Ali, at the time, the best boxer in the world, refused to be drafted to go fight in Vietnam. You didn't have the president of the United States at the time. I think Johnson was the president, though it may have been Nixon in there. It was about a 5-year period where
it was both
he was
of
off.
Them, yeah.
Yeah. Neither of them, you know, ever brought that into the culture war in a broader way.
Well, actually, Nixon did specifically, and he had a lot of negative things to say about the Nation of Islam and Muhammad Ali.
But I don't think in the same way that Trump has done here, where Trump has not just, I guess he didn't start this controversy, but he certainly threw gasoline on it and has now turned it around to something that is, it's about him more than it is about anything else. There was an article in the Tennessean this morning about the protests that the Titans and Seahawks carried out yesterday. Neither team came out on the field for the national anthem. They both stayed in the locker rooms. The article, maybe 800 words long, talking about the protest and quoting various players and coaches and staffers and fans, never once in the article does it mention what the protest was about. It mentions Trump's tweets. It mentions players' reaction to Trump. Never in there is there any reference to Kaepernick, to police violence, to the point
but
of
this
the whole
is
thing,
to,
right?
To go to the point of golden ageism, and Andrew, I hesitate to say—
To my credit, you know, as you guys remember, I'm from a Rockwell painting, so this makes sense to me.
You're from that Rockwell painting where the
he's the turkey
where the
on the
where
table.
the policeman is arresting the little boy in the diner, right, and beating him.
Well, yeah,
tasing
he provoked him.
He was a visionary, but sports is often seen as a kind of redoubt from like serious activity. And I think that's wrong. I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of the role that sports has always played. So, you know, Eric mentioned in 1968, it wasn't just African-American athletes protesting. Like throughout, many people from post-colonial or newly freed colonies, as well as students in Mexico City protested outside those games. The Olympics, the modern Olympics, were created by a French guy, launched in 1896 as a way to avenge the loss of France in the Franco-Prussian War. On a nationalistic basis, that's why people compete for nations, not as individuals, which would have, you know, been an equally valid choice. Politics always infuses everything we do, particularly cultural activities, and sports is part of that. And I think it's wrong to somehow think that this is going to be a place free of that. Just as TV, creative work and everything, there is a question of like what happens when things get politicized all of the time or immediately, so that, you know, whether it's, you know, Steve Scalise or Gabby Giffords being shot, and you throw out the basic humanity in a reaction where it's like, where like when a congressman gets shot, people on the other side are like, oh, well, you know, they immediately try to turn it to political advantage. I think that's unseemly, and we have crept into that world fully formed. But I like the idea that sports is a place where we can discuss a lot of different things that matter to people. There's a new movie out called Battle of the Sexes, which is about the match that Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs had, about the Battle of the Sexes in the early 70s. Sports has always been politicized, and it's better, I think, that we admit that, and then, you know, we don't have to turn it into a shitty conversation. But it's actually it's a good place to talk about a lot of stuff. And certainly in the civil rights movement, it was absolutely central and effective. Sports was a significant way in which blacks were able to show that they had, they had absolute claims to equality. Later, Billie Jean King is fascinating because she brought pay parity to tennis, she created a players union for tennis players. I mean, she was a very political character, even as she was, you know, almost the equivalent of Muhammad Ali for a certain period in women's tennis.
I will say, though, I mean, I rarely want to say this sentence, but in Trump's defense, the tweet that is getting the most attention, he says, sports fans should never condone players that do not stand proud for their national anthem or their country. NFL should change policy. So at least there, what he is doing is putting the locus on fans and on the NFL. Again, like the whole Trump shit show in here is bad, but I do think we should give him credit for he could easily have said in that tweet, you know, time for hearings or as president, I'm going to blah. And he didn't. But I think there is something also to the wag the dog theory here. When you look at the tweet, look at his tweet stream, that tweet is sandwiched between a tweet about repeal and replace and a tweet about extreme vetting, right? I mean, there is a lot going on in D.C. right now. And the fact that those two tweets together got fewer retweets than the or fewer likes than the NFL tweet probably tells us something about maybe how good he is.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. I share the opinion that when Trump goes off on these somewhat odd tangents, that there's some kind of reasoning behind it. Occasionally, I think that there's just sort of a weird instinct he has to go anywhere that has more attention than him at any given moment. But it would seem that there's some degree of calculation that's going into all of this.
Sure. He and, like, my three-year-old have the same instinct
the
of,
same
like,
sense, yeah.
You know, the adults are
Pay
talking. I'm just going
to
stand in the middle and say my own thing until people...
Just two quick points on that, though. First, and I think this applies to what Mnuchin said, too, and I just like Catherine said, I don't want to defend Steve Mnuchin. I wish we were sitting here talking about how he's wasted, millions of taxpayer dollars since he'd become Treasury Secretary. There's more important things to talk about. But I think both Trump and Mnuchin are saying that they want the NFL to change their policy. And they're using the bully pulpit, I think, inappropriately to put pressure on the NFL to change their policy. Mnuchin says, you know, that the NFL has rules about like what stickers players can wear on their helmets. And he thinks this should be in that same category, that they shouldn't be allowed to kneel for the national anthem. I think that's inappropriate and wrong. I'm not sure that it's actually the free speech issue, not to say that it's not a free speech issue because it is, but I think it's really more a question of whether government should be putting pressure on private institutions to change their rules. And I think that's the thing that really unified the players and the owners, going back to the point Nick made earlier yesterday. I mean, Saeed Khan, the owner of the Jacksonville Jaguars, donated to Trump's campaign a lot of money to Trump's campaign, but yet he was on the sidelines with his players yesterday in London when they kicked off that game with his arms linked in a show of solidarity with the players. Because the point is, you know, we as owners and players are not going to let you in the government tell us what to do. We're going to work out these questions on our own. And then secondly, just to the culture war thing, Trump absolutely is incentivized to, you know, to go after the thing that gets the most attention. He's always done that, and he's done it, you know, I guess somewhat successfully, but it's because he doesn't engage on questions of law and policy, right? That's most of what governing is legal questions and policy questions. The courts have shut down some of the things he's tried to do. Congress has shut down some of the things he's tried to do, largely or at least partially, because he's not gotten involved on the legal and the policy questions. And we're going to talk about some of that later in the podcast here. So he defaults back to the only thing he really understands, which is the culture war, which is the thing that has a much lower barrier of entry, not just for him, but for everybody else. And that's why these types of issues blow up the way they do. And we don't get to have the substantial conversation that we should have about the policy.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. So you're implying that Trump engages in this because it's low-hanging fruit that doesn't require broad-based knowledge of the actual subject?
It's literally the only fruit he can reach. I don't think he has any desire or interest in reaching the higher fruit, the thing that actually
he's like a dissipated Roman emperor in a Caravaggio painting. He's lying on his back and people are dropping peeled grapes.
Yeah, it's not even low
mouth.
Hanging, yeah. Right? It's being brought to him on a silver tray. Yeah, right.
So before we go off of football, Eric, I think you're more of the football fan between the people currently talking. Are you in?
That's a low bar.
speaking of low hanging.
I suspect that if you were to take a poll of libertarians, you would find that there's not as much rah-rah team sports that goes on with libertarians. It's my guess based on folks I've spoken to. But what I wanted to ask you, though, was Trump did go into the sport being ruined by referees that were stopping people from getting concussions. From my vantage point as not a football fan, I'm not terribly bothered by that. But that seems to be an issue right now of whether or not they should curtail the sport in terms of injury. What do you think?
I mean, the reality is they are curtailing the sport, but they're doing it for very good reasons, which is, you know, not committing as many, you know, violent head injuries or not having as many violent head injuries. I think this gets into a whole lot of other questions about the NFL and about the NFL's knowledge and admittance of its concussion problem and what has, you know, become not just a public health problem for the NFL, but literally a question of survival. Because when you see the rates of youth that are not playing football, or you've seen the drop off in, you know, participation, that eventually filters up to weaken the product that the NFL puts on the field if kids are choosing to play basketball or soccer or whatever when they're kids,
right? Or lacrosse,
yeah.
And it does
so it gets
seem
into a
I
lot
was
of
actually
other questions, yeah.
I was just talking to, and some of this is not necessarily, you know, it's not going to be worked out in a legal framework and payouts and stuff like that. But Eric is right that the pipeline, which begins really in Pop Warner, Pee Wee football, is slowly drying up. And it's something similar to what happened with boxing, where boxing is being supplanted by mixed martial arts for a variety of reasons, one of which is the obvious punishment that it deals out to its best practitioners. And so if you... You know, if you get to be Muhammad Ali and you end up with, boxing-induced Parkinson's disease or Joe Frazier or any number of boxers who end up punch drunk, and there's an alternative, people who might have gone into boxing are going to choose something else. It's the same thing with football. And unlike sports like hockey and perhaps lacrosse, in soccer, it seems very difficult for football to be able to come up with a way to change the rules that will minimize the amount of obvious damage that gets done. And we are starting to see this in a lot of ways, Andrew, and this might go to your point that, like, a lot of people don't want to see sports politicized or sports as something more serious than a game on the field. But sports viewership in many ways and in many places is down, particularly among things like the NFL. ESPN, the sports network, is having problems because people are choosing to watch more different things. And it may be that, sport is still hugely popular and will be, but public tastes are shifting, and we like different types of spectacles, different types of sports. And I think in general, it's a good thing, but it does mean, potentially a death knell for the NFL and a variety of other sports part of the landscape for 50 or 100
Americans
years.
Have always loved sports, and I think Americans will continue to love sports, but the only constant there is change, right? If you go back 75 years, boxing and horse racing were the most popular sports in America, and baseball. And,
the late 19th century, human racing, like foot racing was a mass, and cycling.
Well, so here's the thing,
cycling
though.
was a real spectator sport.
I think the way that you interpret that shift is a really big division between maybe right and left, maybe sort of dynamic and static. Like, if you see, as Donald Trump implies in his tweet, as you hear from the kind of pro-manliness neocon zone, that our movement away from these violent, direct, interpersonal sports to something that's, softer, that's more monitored, that's more more focused on finesse or skill, that's a loss to our society, that we no longer have the sort of classical virtues of physical courage and that's something that, will ultimately cause the decline of American civilization, versus it's to sort of say, listen, we also just in general, like, blows to the head are a thing that are in decline all around, like, which is a good thing.
This is why the British Empire, the sun set on it.
Well, right. I mean, that is a genuine view that people really hold.
Yeah.
And I think to fail to grapple with that, when as someone who's absolutely on the other side of that equation, who says, like, yes, it is a sign of progress and something excellent that we are now hesitant to send our young boys in to be smacked repeatedly in the head to teach them how to be a man. But that's a real divide in America. And Trump is on the other side of it.
Yeah, no. And it's a broader worldview that I think actually is beyond politics or typical ideology, because Trump, on every level, he looks at any deviation from what he took to be American culture when he was, in his teens or early 20s. And, time kind of stopped for him there. And that's why, he's bragging about trying to bring back factory jobs and things like that. I mean, like, he's stuck in the 70s and not a good 70s either. It's odd because he can't admit that crime is down, because he's like, he thinks about, okay, well, what was great about the 70s was football and, sassy broads, but not too sassy, and, factory jobs and, this and that, and bad, like urban crime. And I think on the left, you see, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that's what the 2016 election was about, really, between Hillary and Trump. And it helps explain, I think, in an optimistic way, why neither of them could win a majority of the popular vote. They were kind of stuck in dueling versions of the past. And we really do need, we need to start thinking about how the future is different and is actually a kind of an alleviation of a lot of this bad stuff. And you're right. I mean, like, what kind, who would be against the progress of, like, where two guys are going to be standing next to each other and literally just hitting themselves in the head, either with football helmets on or just using their fists? We need to really break with the past and with politicians who want us to, you know, kind of remake their childhoods.
I just want to flag that I think peak sassy broad was really the late 40s, and that, you know, the 70s were
Rosalind Russell Institute said the same thing. It peaks around 1938 and then it drops down a little bit, comes back 1942, then really declines up till 1983. So I think you're right about that.
You really committed to that bit there.
Thank you. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
If you said the uptick started in 1980, the year of my birth, you could have won me over forever.
But alas, I missed my opportunity.
Carry the sassy broad banner as best
I can. Well, I'm
going
to pivot slightly. So a lot of the content that Trump has been working with and talking about publicly came from his Friday speech in Alabama, where he skewered referees and he skewered football players, but he also skewered John McCain and went off of John McCain for not supporting the Graham Cassidy bill, which is the before the deadline until the legislation goes back to the non-reconciliation process, if I've got that right. This is the next attempt of the Republican Party, the Senate Republicans, to repeal and replace Obamacare by Senators Graham and Cassidy. The votes are very tight right now. McCain came out saying that he wasn't going to vote for it. Rand Paul has been a consistent no. Ted Cruz, I think, is a no as of now. And Susan Collins is also a probably not. However, as of today, the latest revisions to the bill have kind of added candy to it for states of Arizona, Kentucky, and Alaska. So we're adding Senator Murkowski to the mix.
Why do you think those states matter?
Yeah, why would they matter?
Those states, what do they have in common?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Well, in Alaska, too, it's like they get a 25% hike in federal matching funds for Medicaid. So there's a really nice apparent bribe to me that's going on there. So Graham Cassidy, that could be the Republican way of going forward and getting out of Obamacare. Eric, I know that you've been following this. Do you think Graham Cassidy is a good bill? Are you in favor of it passing?
I and our healthcare aficionado here at Reason, Peter, I think both of us have sort of taken the opinion that we're not really, you know, this isn't necessarily good or bad. It's not a great bill. It certainly doesn't repeal Obamacare. Any attempt to say that it does, I think Rand Paul has talked about that and has been accurate in saying that this is really, you know, it doesn't repeal most of the subsidies. It doesn't repeal the taxes. That's not what this is. This is an attempt to get a political win. It's an attempt to get something across the finish line. And the clock is ticking here. They really only have until September 30th to do anything on health care with fewer than 60 votes in the Senate because of the odd rules of the reconciliation process, which we won't go into here. But if they don't get this vote by September 30th, they would need Democratic support, which obviously they would not have to repeal parts of Obamacare. And so at this point, it really is just, hey, let's get something across the finish line. So the bill would remove funding for Planned Parenthood. It would change funding for Medicaid. It would essentially block grant all of the Obamacare money to the states and then sort of turn the states loose to spend that money however they want, except there's a whole bunch of suggestions that have been made about putting up guardrails for how the states can use that money. I'm skeptical of the idea that this will actually lead to more experimentation or innovation at the state level, because I think the federal government is ultimately going to dictate what the states can do with that money. It looks to me largely, when you look at the comments and the responses that people have gotten to asking senators about what they think of the bill, it seems largely like they want to vote, the ones who are in support of it want to vote for something just so they can go home to their constituents and say that they actually voted to repeal Obamacare and actually passed something.
And in fact, that's the explicit argument that Graham and Cassidy are making for the bill. They are literally saying out loud to the press, we got to do this because our constituents will be mad if we don't do something, which is, you know, in a perfect world, not an argument you should be making for a major piece of legislation.
This is what you get down to after you had a bill that passed the House back, just, you know, to recap the whole history here. A bill passed the House in March, I think it was, that did repeal significant portions of Obamacare, changed a bunch of the rules. That got over to the Senate, didn't go anywhere. They tried a few different iterations of that in the end of July. There was that week where there were three different health care bills culminating in the skinny repeal bill, they called it, which was the one that John McCain torpedoed at 2 in the morning in maybe the most dramatic dramatic Senate floor action that you will ever see on C-SPAN. And then, you know, now we come up against this deadline, and Congress works best when there's a deadline. And so here we are 5 days before September 30th. And they want to pass something. But at this point, it really is just about throwing as much candy at certain senators as you can to try and get them on board.
And I got to say, if John McCain is bribable in this circumstance now, then I honestly don't even know what the point of politics is anymore. I mean, dude is A, dying, B, just got like a huge amount of praise for knocking a dumber version of this thing down, C, has made a big deal about the regular order, the lack of regular order in this process, right? So there's no time for a CBO score. There's no time for any of the stuff that even the bare minimum of responsible legislation should contain. Who is the person who's like, let's put a little extra cash in there for Arizona, and that's going to win that guy over? And moreover, if he does vote for this in the end, like, can we stop with the hashtag so brave with John McCain?
Oh, God. But does anybody buy that anymore?
Yes, other people than love the kind that of liberal? Shit, Nick.
I was going to say, but the liberal media, I hate that kind of phrase,
never
but
again.
I'm saying people in the mainstream media want him to be maverick, you know, still. And it's like when he was running for president, he caved on one of his signature issues, on which I agreed with him, which was he was generally open to more immigration and more legal immigration to the country. And he flipped when he had to run to the right of Mitt Romney and show that, no, he too disliked Mexicans. You know, and that's enough. And also, he's never been particularly coherent or, I think, positive. But, you know, that's a separate issue. What I was going to ask you guys, from a purely libertarian perspective, small-L libertarian, it's clear this is not a good bill. And we don't really want this to be the capstone of kind of the Obamacare, you know, episode, because it's going to leave in place like a lot of terrible stuff, but it will also kind of settle things for a while. But is it better than the status quo? And I guess this is a larger question, because libertarians are often, you know, said, oh, well, you know, the problem with you guys temperamentally, you know, small L libertarians, is that you can't do politics because politics is about compromise. It's about what's possible. And like, you know, it's clear like the Republican Party has completely shit the bed on healthcare going back to, I would argue, going back to just in the 21st century to when George W. Bush for re-election created the, you know, pushed the Medicare prescription D, free drugs for old people who didn't necessarily need them, independent really, and, you know, of need. But you can go back further than that to when Ronald Reagan, who had been an opponent of both Social Security and Medicare in the early 60s, then ended his presidency by saying, like, the greatest legacy, and he actually said this, was putting, you know, New Deal entitlements on firm financial footing, which was also not actually true. But, you know, what
they're
do you do with
something
like this?
They're not on firm footing, you mean? Wait, you mean there's a problem with entitlements? We should talk about that. Yeah.
No, but I mean this seriously. Like, right. You know, and I think Rand Paul has really done a true service by insisting and being a man of principle. And it reminded me, like, when he said, there's no fucking way I'm going to vote for this. He came into office giving a great speech early on where he talked about, you know, how Henry Clay, the great, you know, the greatest politician from Kentucky, the great compromiser. Rand Paul actually gave an early speech where he said, I'm not, you know, there are things that you do not compromise on. And Henry Clay, in fact, made a bunch of, you know, not just legal or political, but ethical mistakes when he compromised on the idea of slavery. You know, I like that. And I want to see that. And I want to see Obamacare repealed. And I want to see, you know, Congress get to providing a framework to getting the government out of healthcare and creating a more market-based system. But, you know, I mean, where are we left? Because if we, you know, like, I mean, is there, you know, just from a broad libertarian perspective, what do you do when there are only two really bad options on the table and there's not even a Gary Johnson to vote for?
I think,
you know, kind of in terms of legislation.
I think the right answer there is to not support this bill, which I think Rand is right to do that. I mean, here's a shocker you won't hear anywhere else on the Reason podcast. I think Rand Paul is right about this.
Breaking. Reason staffer likes
Hashtag
Rand Paul.
So
exactly. No, but I think you're right, Nick, that he's standing on principle about this. And I think that that is the basis for eventually getting something better. And I think Obamacare is not going to continue to carry on. It's not going to be able to continue to carry on. This is a crisis that we will have to revisit in the coming years. If we don't get something passed by September 30th, we shouldn't see that as, and Republicans and even Democrats, for that matter, shouldn't see this as the end of the world. Don't vote for a bad bill now just to get something passed. So I think Rand is right. He's taken that stance on principle that he's not going to support something that leaves in place all of these taxes and subsidies and fees that Obamacare established. And then I think McCain, back to Catherine's point, I mean, McCain has absolutely put himself in a position where if he goes the other way on this now, he looks really real. I don't even see a way that he can realistically do it, because he's based his entire opposition around this idea of normal order, regular order in the Senate. And there's no way that this bill goes through anything resembling regular order between now and 5
well,
days.
And it's the idea of like not having time for CBO scores and stuff like that. And, you know, Catherine, this is, I think, you know, a particular 21st century phenomenon where we had first under Bush, and I know we documented it at Reason in various ways, and then under Obama, but like an absolute dismissal of regular budget order. There was so much war funding and stuff like that under Bush that was off the books. And then Obama, you know, failed to, to even have a Democratic majority actually put forth budgets. We haven't had a budget that has gone through the regular budget process in years. And that's the original sin, I think, in terms of where the government is not even doing, you know, it's not even following the rules that it is set out to, like, you know, I mean, to make sure that you, you know, you didn't leave the stove on when you go on vacation or something like that. And I guess I would be interested in seeing senators on both sides of the aisle or congressmen actually say, you know what, we have fucked up. They need to do a Domino's Pizza apology tour and say, you know what, we've been fucking off for the past 10 years or more, and we have to really redo things and start following our own rules and restrictions to, you know, just to, regardless of the content of the legislation we are not passing or the bad legislation we're passing.
Well, this is also the reason that we absolutely shouldn't trust any tax reform bill that contains mandatory cuts to be announced later, right? I mean, this is because the norm of budgetary processing in Washington is now emergency spending, continuing resolutions, last minute stopgap, you know, bullshit every single time. You know, there's a bunch of different ways we could be doing tax reform right now. And some of them are ostensibly revenue neutral, although that's always, that should always raise skepticism in the heart of readers. But those that require, that sort of put deeper cuts in place in exchange for promised, in exchange for promised spending cuts, I don't see the capability to do that in the current Congress or in any 21st century Congress.
So we're going to get to tax reform in a moment. Nick, I'd like to offer a tepid defense of the Graham Cassidy bill, which if I were senator, I don't know that I would vote on it. But one of the things that does appeal to me about it is that it does seem to be placing more variance, or at least attempting to be placing more variance on healthcare between states, which I like for two reasons. I'm a fan of the laboratories of democracy. I think that that's good. From a healthcare perspective, I don't have a problem with Vermont trying to enact single-payer healthcare and Texas pursuing a more market-based reform. I don't think that would happen under Graham Cassidy, as I understand it, because it seems to me that that there's really not a lot of maneuverability for market-based reform on a state level. But the other reason that I kind of like the idea of going that direction is it seems to me that healthcare is going to remain this Manichaean battle between blue and red for the rest of our lifetimes. And I'm not really sure how we ever arrive at a suitable conclusion for either side. And it might be that we just have a state-by-state patchwork, where blue states can do what they want and red states can do what they want. So I do see some benefits to what he's attempting or what they're attempting to do, although I don't think they'll wind up pulling it off.
Manichaean, though, there implies
that you want it to be called Womachaean?
Yes.
Just
that's
out
right.
of gender equity?
The thing is, though,
so tedious.
The thing is, though, if this is a Manichaean issue, that implies that there's righteousness on the part of the right, right? They don't have, it's not good versus evil, it's good versus meh. It's good versus we don't know what the fuck we're doing. And by good, I, of course, mean evil in this case. But it's not, you know, I think I would rather have an all-out civilization-ending battle between the power of centralization and the power of free markets. And that is not what's going on, even though that's what people on the left think is what's going on.
Yeah, and
I'm pretty sure the new Thor movie about Ragnarok is actually about healthcare policy.
I think it might
Asgard.
Be. Yeah,
dude,
Asgardian
Peter Suderman
healthcare,
is about to write that hot take in 5 seconds.
I'm sure there's an interpretation.
You know what?
There.
But Catherine is actually right too. Where you know a lot of the opposition at the state level to Graham Cassidy comes from Republican governors in states where. You know, the Medicaid, in every state in the country, Medicaid is either the single biggest or the second biggest budget item for a state. And it becomes this is not really, it isn't, you know, a socialist medicine versus free market capitalism or anything. It's guys mostly who are just trying to figure out how they get as much money as possible with as few strings attached, in order to spend in inefficient and ineffective programs. And that cuts across both
sides. I think
you're
right about that. And then just to add to that, I think what this really is about passing the buck or not wanting to pass the buck. I mean, Republicans in Congress don't want to face campaign ads for the next, 2, 4, 6 years claiming that they cut Medicaid spending to the states and they pushed grandma off a cliff and whatnot. So they want to push this and they're framing this. And Graham Cassidy they've both done this deliberately, framing this as hey, we're going to give the states more flexibility. We're going to push it off to the states. We're going to let them be the decision makers on this so they can later say, hey, if your Medicaid got cut, that's not on me. That's on your governor. And governors don't want, many governors at least, don't want that responsibility for the same reason, because they know Medicaid is ultimately bankrupt, is ultimately not going to continue. You know, there's going to have to be cuts someday, that this is not going to be able to continue forever, and that they don't want to be blamed for it either. They would much rather blame Congress for their state's problems than to have to take that responsibility on themselves. And then Heaton, I think to your point, I mean, Chris Jacobs at the Texas Public Policy Foundation has pointed out that there's a lot of restrictions in the bill. They talk about it being, flexibility for the states and letting the states decide what to do with this $1.1 trillion that will be handed out every year between 2020 and 2027. But ultimately, the HHS, whoever is running HHS, the secretary, gets to set the policies for what the states can do. So a future Democratic administration, even a future Republican administration, could come in and, just like happened under Obamacare, all of a sudden you have a whole bunch of new rules written by HHS to govern how this thing works as a practical matter of policy that was never actually, those rules that were never actually passed through Congress.
I want the agency, HHS, that launched the absolute shittiest website in history. I want
absolutely.
Them to be in charge of writing the rules.
I think
rules.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Eric, the other question that I have on this is, as just a regular Joe who doesn't know healthcare policy very well.
You don't know much about
that's
book
that's right.
Either,
I'm just, sleeves rolled up.
Is that your the anvil I hear you hammering on in the background?
I
the spreading chestnut.
I dabble in smithing. It's one of my many hobbies.
That's the most Brooklyn thing you've ever said.
I dabble in smithing.
I dabble in. Yeah, I like to make my own horseshoes. They're organic. So from my perspective, the thing that irritates me most about the healthcare system is employer based insurance, which, by the way, thrilled to be at Reason. Very happy, but...
Yeah, well, you know what? We were looking at, that suspicious string of cold medicines that you bought.
It seems to me that's something where people are basically stuck in whatever job they're in, and they can't go create their own jobs. It's much more difficult to go out and become an entrepreneur because you're absolutely frightened to leave the safety net of the company that you're at.
I'm sorry to cut in on you, Andrew, but I guarantee you right now that anybody who says I would have started the next Google, except I didn't want to give up a high deductible, low premium plan, they're lying about the company they were going to start. No entrepreneur ever didn't create a company because of workplace.
Wait, I mean, really? I don't know. You've got a spouse and a kid,
yes.
and you're gonna not have healthcare for a while. Like I could see that having a chilling effect on entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Not good.
You can't really prove that negative, but I think, we should remember that the reason we have this sort of employer-based healthcare policy in the first place is a workaround for government-imposed restrictions on wages, right? That were implemented
absolutely.
During World War
II. The original sin's absolutely from that.
And so,
but what I was going to get at is, I think the only people that have the only sides that have been trying to get rid of that original sin are either single payer or, so far as I know, Rand Paul on having a variety of different co-ops and combinations of you go through the Rotary Foundation or you go through the NRA or something like that. Am I right in thinking that those are kind of the only
I'm betting the NRA's health care
plan. That's not a pool I'd want to put together, to be honest.
Yeah, that's...
Although also, I mean, you can get health insurance, or used to be able to get health insurance through the Freelancers Union, which is another pool of degenerate, unhealthy monsters I would definitely not insure.
Yeah, I want to pay into the NFL players, even though the premiums are higher, because they're more likely to have, cover things. But
I mean, I think, like, philosophically, that's the direction things should go, right? Like, but that requires a government that says, well, we're going to let markets kind of figure this thing out on their own, and it's a need
the first thing that we need, and this goes to the tax reform issue, what we need is a tax code that does not treat healthcare benefits as income, as something other than regular income, because right now I don't even know, I'm on the Reason healthcare plan, I don't know what portion of our of total outlays for employees that health benefits covering people at Reason cost the company. But the fact is that and as everybody here has kind of hinted at, it was back in during World War II and right after, where there were wage and price controls on things, and companies could offer fringe benefits such as healthcare and retirement plans that were not taxed as regular income. I would much rather get my full salary and have it be taxed at a lower, fairer rate, and then go out into the market for using those extra dollars to buy healthcare. And I think that's, like, we need that clarity now more than ever, because, a company like Reason doesn't have, I mean, we're struggling to be good journalists and policy analysts. Like, do we really have the expertise to figure out who the fuck, what healthcare company should be providing medical insurance for everybody at Reason? It's like, it's a waste of energy and a drain on us. Plus, it reduces choices, and it screws up market mechanisms that would otherwise probably absolutely be.
Yeah, and everybody's needs are going to be different. Somebody who's single and young is going to have a different set of needs than somebody who's older and has kids.
Thank you for the subsidies, guys.
There you go. And so that's the situation that when you have you might offer three or four plans. I think Reason is very generous to offer three, maybe. Being able to go out on the marketplace and buy whatever fits your needs is really, that's what everybody should do. That's what we do with TVs. I mean, why can't we do that with
the general opacity also of, I mean, a pay stub used to be literally just the stub off the bottom of your check. And now it's so many lines, so many different programs, so many different types of taxes, so many different levels of withholding that are subject to different levels of taxation, and it's all completely opaque. None of us can see any of it. This is what Nick was saying earlier. We don't even know what percentage we pay of our own health care for the most part. And I think we should all take a minute here to burn in effigy an otherwise great man, Milton Friedman, who came up with the idea of withholding.
Who helped?
Fuck you, yeah. Uncle Milton.
Well, or he worked out the technical details. But yeah, it's true. I mean, like, think about it. And we're all libertarians on this podcast. Like, does any of us know what our monthly premiums are, much less, like, what we paid out of pocket last year in healthcare? And if we don't, like, how the fuck that's signaling, very clearly that we, that prices are not at work. I know what my monthly mortgage is because I pay that every month, out of my own pocket, and I negotiated that price. I don't know what my monthly health care.
I really hope our CFO is not listening to the podcast. We're very sorry, John Graff, for all of this.
Yeah. No, he's been siphoning it off. He's living in the in the Turks and Caicos now.
So all of these things are things that I would like to see built into tax reform. That would be absolutely wonderful. I don't believe it's anything that is being debated in tax reform, although that is the next big Republican push. The Gang of Six and President Trump are endeavoring to lower the corporate tax rate. I think Trump allegedly wants it to be 15%, but I think the Republicans have basically said they're going to try and get it down to 25%. And then he would also like to lower the top marginal tax rate. So those are the big focus, the big issues of reform that the Republicans want to do. It seems to me that lowering the corporate tax rate is a good idea. But I'm seeing things from lots of different sources that say, on the one hand, that it's not actually going to benefit workers. It's just going to benefit the people that own the shares. It would seem to me that it's just kind of a covert tax. But I'm not sure. Catherine, do you think the direction they're going is a good one, or do you think that this is just another weird side that the Republicans are going on?
Yeah, I mean, generally, I think, you know, lowering the corporate tax rate, America's is among the highest in the world, is a good idea. I think the fiddling around with the estate tax question is much more fraught, and it is a thing about which reasonable libertarians can disagree. But to my mind, you know, I am going to be pissed at Republicans if they put me in a place where I am opposing tax cuts, because I love me some tax cuts. I want to cut all the taxes, but I don't want to cut them if it means that we're just imposing tremendous costs on the next generation. And, you know, the way around that is to also cut spending, to cut spending, to cut fucking spending, to cut the spending. You take some spending and you fucking cut it. But that is not something that Congress is good at, which then puts us in a position of kind of dicking around with stuff that's revenue neutral. I do think the form of the tax code matters. I think that it incentivizes behavior in very, very strong and specific ways. I disagree with Nick about the fact that entrepreneurs are not discouraged because of employer mandated health care. But
I just in my defense, I said good entrepreneurs.
Even good entrepreneurs. People, good entrepreneurs have cash flow problems, and health care is part of that. Anyway. And so, yes, I want to see smarter, better tax code. I think some of the proposals on the table are good. I think proposals that are going to result in more debt are bad and should be rejected and are very likely to be the proposals we actually adopt.
Yeah, we've had this whole second round of what's the matter with Kansas analyses in the last year, right after Kansas had these huge tax cuts and then massive had to actually then go back and raise taxes because they didn't cut spending in, you know, commensurate to the tax cuts that they'd implemented a few years ago. That's a lesson. Congress should look at that, and they shouldn't look at that and say, well, we can't cut taxes. They should look at that and say, well, when we do cut taxes, we have to also cut spending. You have to make those things balance out, and you can't rely on the magical fairy of economic growth, which is what a lot of projections surely will rely on once we see them.
I think you just found my Halloween costume for me.
Magical fairy of economic growth.
The magical fairy of economic growth stimulated by tax cuts.
Right, like 7% GDP growth in perpetuity will pay for a heck of a lot of tax cuts. But is that realistic? Probably not. So you got to cut the spending.
It's a sign, by the way, that a lot of people in the free market world, and particularly people like Grover Norquist by name, you know, they have not come to terms with the Kansas experiment, which was a complete failure for exactly the reason that you're talking about, Eric, which is that they made massive tax cuts and they did not cut spending. And this has been what Republicans have done for, you know, since Ronald Reagan. I mean, they don't really cut spending year over year, and then they cut taxes and they promise more and more taxes and they say, don't worry, it'll pay for itself, et cetera. Or then the variation under George W. Bush was Dick Cheney's deficits don't matter. There will come a time where deficits matter. There is every reason to believe that the massive deficits in the national debt that we're pushing reduces economic growth, which is the way that standards of living grow over time. I'll throw out here, and you know, I'm happy to kind of try and defend it. I don't know how well I'll be able to defend it. I don't think we should be monkeying with the tax code right now, because I think the question is spending, and that we have to de-link tax cuts and spending for the reason Catherine pointed out, because that conversation goes one way. We will cut taxes now and we will cut spending later, and those spending cuts never come. And Republicans or conservatives can't blame Democrats for that. They've had control of the government, and the last time there was unified control of the government by Republicans under George W. Bush, we came out of 8 years of Bush spending 50% more in real terms than when he went in. And you could say, oh, you know, it was this or that or whatever, but that's just the fact. And I actually think we should be, if anything, we should be talking about raising taxes, because it's my theory, and I have some evidence to back this up, that when people, you know, one of the problems is we have Groupon government, where it's like we are getting a dollar's worth of government services for about 75 cents of actual tax money that is revenue that comes out of our pocket. Of course, you're going to buy more than you would otherwise if you're not paying full freight. We should, I think it would be a great thing for Congress to say, you know what, in the fairness of a balanced budget, we're spending $4 trillion a year. We are declaring next year we're going to start collecting $4 trillion in taxes. And very quickly will people say, we'll look at programs and they'll say, you know what, there is no fucking way that's worth it. Let's get rid of that completely. And I predict if you tried something like that or even had a conversation staged around that, then you would you would see a radical consensus for cutting government spending and government action.
See, I always think, though, this argument of once it gets bad enough, once people see that it's bad enough, then they're going to come around to our way of thinking. No, they're always just like, oh, no, I'm cool with how bad it is. That's where we always end up.
Or worse than that, what they're going to say is, well, this is bad. Other people should pay more for this thing that I want. Like, that's where this conversation goes, is not, well, let's have a national conversation about what government programs we can do without. It goes the, hey, guys, we need to talk about how the rich people aren't paying enough to support our government programs.
Frame the conversation. If we're raising about $3.5 trillion a year in taxes, it's like, that's it, you know. And it's like you're going into your kid's room and you're saying, like, you know, you had that credit card. I gave you that credit card for emergencies. You're using it for like everyday purchases. You make this amount of money. Give me the credit card back. And again, I'm saying, like, you know, and we have covered times where both the United States and other countries have cut spending both as a percentage of GDP or year over year. Good things happen when that happens. And we need to be having that conversation, because this is as unsustainable as, you know, Medicaid funding or Medicare funding and all of that kind of stuff. And we need to frame, I think we need to frame a conversation not about tax cuts, because the kind of, if you're into markets, whether you're conservative or libertarian, or even many centrist liberals understand this, that tax cuts can start economic growth, which is the goal in a lot of ways. Like, long-term economic growth is what makes better living possible. But we have, you know, we don't have any credibility, and that connection between cutting taxes, starting economic growth, and everything getting better has become pretty shaky. And a lot of people don't even know that there's a kind of formula there.
So you're
I will also say, I think that the worst case scenario, I disagree with Nick that we should raise taxes in order to deal with this problem and to highlight it. But I do think that the worst case scenario is temporary tax cuts that sunset, because then you don't get any of the confidence in the entrepreneurial and, you know, even in the sort of big business sector about what their landscape looks like going forward. Also, if the temporary tax cuts are on capital gains, people's investment planning is increasingly subject to political risk, which is not something that we want. If we're going to cut taxes, and I think we should, I just think we should cut spending with it, to do it in a temporary manner loses so many of the benefits, particularly the type of benefits that drive growth. You are setting yourself up for failure if you say, I'm going to cut taxes, we're going to have 6% growth, and everything's going to be great, but these tax cuts sunset in 10 years. That's you have now, it's your
which
perfect
equation
for failure.
Which means in 7 years, we start the conversation about raising them again, et cetera. And I also agree, what is really, Catherine was getting at, too, of the idea of using taxes to incentivize particular behavior. And, you know, obviously, we're all familiar, vice taxes partly are supposed to pay, you know, taxes on cigarettes or liquor. It's partly to discourage that activity, and it's partly to pay for the harms caused by that. And it's also, you know, it's an easy tax to pass because, you know, everybody feels guilty about doing this or that. But we need to, you know, we need to get away from that, certainly in the federal income tax, in the federal tax system, where we're not saying, oh, it's a good thing to buy houses, so we're going to give you a home mortgage deduction. It's a good thing to buy health care relative to Cheetos, so we're going to give, you know, we're not going to tax health care benefits as regular income. Like, we need, you know, I mean, we really need to articulate, and this is something where I think a lot of people in the policy world on either side of the issue assume a lot of knowledge that a lot of people don't have and would be very open to, you know, we need to, God, how many fucking national conversations do we need to be having? But it's, you know, we need to talk about what is the function of taxes, you know, and the primary function of taxes is to raise the revenue necessary to pay for government services we all agree on, or as a consensus we have agreed to pay. And I think once you start having that conversation, and that's why I'm somewhat cheekily saying we should raise taxes and force people to pay the full price of something, because then you're like, eh, fuck it. Like, I don't need, you know, I don't need this and I don't need that by the, you know, paid to me by the government. I'd rather have fewer government services and more money to spend however I see fit. But, you know, that we need to be doing that, because there are so many tax expenditures or giveaways built into the tax code, including, you know, and the ultimate one is actually the credit that you get for paying state and local taxes.
Which is one that
Veronique DeRougie
is up right now, isn't it? Isn't that one of the things they're looking to reform?
they are never going to get rid of that for all sorts of reasons, but they have to. Yeah, that is like that's I think the single largest tax expenditure. It's certainly in the top three. And it's like, you know, that allows states that are relatively high tax to get away with more. Because, you know what, like, oh, yeah, you're paying a lot to live in California, in Maryland, in Massachusetts, in New York, in Ohio, but don't worry about it because it comes off your federal taxes. That's, you know, and that, Andrew, if you're interested in federalism and tax competition among the states, that actually is one of the big blunting forces.
No, that makes sense then, because as you say, that it would take off the edge of what you are actually paying in terms of your tax expenditures. Well, everyone, that is the I've reached my saturation point in tax knowledge, and I'm going to digest this and become a better citizen. So I'm going to end it there. But thank you, as always, Eric. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you at home for listening. For Reason, I'm Andrew Heaton.